market insight and analysis. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
And good morning and welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm David Faber, along with Melissa Lee and Mike Santoli. Jim and Carl both have the morning off. Stock markets, as you heard from Becky, we'll say it again, closing early today, 1 p.m. Eastern. The bond market also with an abbreviated session. It will close at 2 p.m. Eastern. Let's give you a look at futures. You're seeing them right now. We do look like we're going to have a higher open when we get started with trading about 30 minutes from now. Let's get to our roadmap this morning. It does begin with, of course, this day, a Black Friday, but like no other, how retailers are shifting their sales strategies online this holiday season.
Then questions over AstraZeneca's vaccine trial, what the CEO is saying this morning.
And finally, what a Salesforce acquisition of Slack means for Microsoft, or would mean. We will discuss that at this hour. David.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, well, right back at you in terms of this market action. Of course, we've seen it a lot, Mike, in terms of the Dow's performance this month. There has been some rotation, I guess. Let's start there. You know, somebody this morning saying, man, aerospace is up 40%, yeah. Which, frankly, I did not necessarily know it has been quite that strong in that short amount of time. Does it continue in terms of this rotation, or do we have to watch that?
You know, it's actually in the last day or day and a half of trading, there's been a little bit of a stutter step in that rotation. And we've had a couple of these since March. One of them peaked in June. Now it's been very, very aggressive. Aerospace, it's part of the industrials group. Industrials fully kind of gotten back to pre-COVID levels. And in fact, the valuations of industrial stocks are well above where they were based on expected earnings 8 months ago. So I think the market has gone a long way into saying things are on the upswing. We've fed off that a lot. If you look at something like copper prices today, globally, the markets are trying to send the message that there's a big rebound coming. Does it come on time? Does it not? And this morning, you see the NASDAQ's actually outperforming again. So I do think you have a little bit of a ebb and flow of those relationships, but it's hard to argue with the general tone of the markets, which is better economic times in 2021. You see a lot of the Wall Street firms also coming out with some pretty aggressive upside targets for the S&P, and whether that's something to believe or to fade is going to be the question in the next couple of months.
I mean, as part of that rotation, we saw the Russell 2000 really outperform this month. This is on track for the best month since the index's inception back in 1984. That's how optimistic people are in terms of banking on that recovery trade on the back of all this positive vaccine news that we've had. But keep in mind, the VIX has remained elevated. So this is a rally that has gone on with record closes and new landmarks like the 30,000 mark for the Dow with some skepticism. It's been above 20 since February 24th, and that's the longest stretch since the financial crisis. So there is some skepticism here. There's expectation for increased volatility, although perhaps, David, some of that volatility could be coming out now that President Trump has said that he will effectively concede if the Electoral College votes for Joe Biden as president, and that vote is December 14th.
Yeah, not something you would think would be a surprise typically,
exactly.
But this is not a typical year, and he certainly has not been a typical president. Take a listen to the president, who again did speak yesterday in that press conference from that little desk that he had, talking about his plan when the Electoral College actually comes in.
So if the Electoral College does elect President-elect Joe Biden, are you not going to leave this building?
Just so you, certainly I will. Certainly I will. And you know that.
But as you say, Melissa, it does erase perhaps a little bit of anxiety in the market. President-elect Biden continues to appoint his cabinet, or at least is giving us the names, of course, subject to Senate confirmation, which I think also is giving some quiescence to the market as well, as they sort of see a lot of fairly steady hands, at least at this point. We haven't had Yellen yet formally announced, but that's certainly been an important one for the market to key off of as well.
And identifying Roger Ferguson as the head of the NEC, Gary Gensler, a longtime Obama administration, quote unquote, top cop, also, by the way, seen as friendly to the cryptocurrency industry. He actually taught a course on blockchain and cryptocurrency at MIT. So, you know, from that perspective, he's seen as sort of, we know where he stands on some of these key issues when it comes to regulation. And that is certainly comforting for the market, that there aren't any of these sort of far left picks. They're much more centrist and moderate. And that, of course, is soothing to the market.
Yeah, I would argue the market has priced itself and behaved as if this is settled. I mean, yes, there's this residual what if this sort of scenarios you can draw out there that maybe there's going to be some disturbance along the political front. But I think the market has moved on to a large degree. And actually, Melissa, it's interesting when this discussion about the volatility index remaining above 20, mm-hmm. a journal had a piece today about mm-hmm. this. There's a couple of little kind of asterisks on that. One is, in 2009, you also had a crash that basically bottomed in March, just like this year, had a massive persistent rally, as we have this year. This date in 2009, we were still over 20. You didn't get down below 20 in that year either, even though the credit markets were less settled than they are right now. So it's not that unusual after a crash for there to be some residual anxiety. The other piece of it, and people talk to me about this all the time, the huge feeding frenzy in retail speculative call options that's been yes. going on for months right now has the effect of actually inflating option prices in a way that filters into the volatility index, in which case a high VIX is not really telling you anything about fear. It's telling you about greed more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some debate over the past couple of months, at least, Mike, as to whether or not the VIX is a true indicator anymore because of that distorting activity. So that's something to watch. I mean, and keep the VIX is only, it measures moves in the market. So
exactly,
it
never really was purely a fear indicator, but it may be less so now than it had been.
Yeah. Finally, Melissa, retail itself, there have been significant surprises there, including some mall-based retailers that have actually performed extremely well. Now, Gap shares did sell off after earnings on Wednesday, but for example, it has been up sharply. Yeah. Somewhat of a surprise, I guess, as we are now at Black Friday, where, by the way, inventories remain quite low, which conceivably is going to be good for margins.
I mean, obviously, people are at home. They're not going to be standing in line in those crazy Black Friday crowds this year. And we have become, I don't want to say understored, but less stored over the course of this year. The one sort of thing that happened with the pandemic is that it accelerates trends, right, in general across industries. And for this particular industry, it accelerated store closures. So in the first half of the year, we had, I believe it was a record number of store closures in the United States. And so that is helping the stronger retailers out there with the stores. And I'm sure, David, after this Black Friday may take on a new meaning this year for many retailers.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to that story, of course. Malls are bracing for a different kind of Black Friday amid the pandemic. Bertha Coombs is at a mall in Paramus, New Jersey, and she has more for us this morning. Bertha.
Hey, David. We are at the Westfield Garden State Plaza, and we are seeing some traffic. They opened early for Black Friday at 7 a.m., and if you take a look, people have been pouring in since sunup, for the most part, but certainly the parking lot is nowhere near as full. One woman told us by this time on a normal year, you couldn't park anywhere near the front of the door to get to a store. It makes her a little sad to see it, but she says in some ways it's a little bit of a silver lining.
Think of huge crowds, but obviously there aren't. So this may actually end up being the best time to come. It might be the safest time.
Yeah, she said she's here because her daughter brought her. She wouldn't have otherwise. But a lot of these mall-based stores have been doing very well online. In fact, Edison Trends says over the last week coming into Thanksgiving, Kohl's, Macy's were both up more than 50%, actually taking some share from rivals like Nordstrom. Of course, they're not doing as well as the big box stores. They continue to be the monster share online. Target up 167%. Best Buy nearly 90%. Walmart better than 80%. Amazon the laggard there up just 65% over the last week. But bear in mind, Amazon is also two-thirds of the market share. The others are just chipping away at it at this point. Amazon remains the big Magilla, as most of us will shop. You know, the National Retail Federation, Melissa, says that 106 million of us will be shopping today, one in three. But that mix is going to be a whole lot different than what we've normally seen in store.
Bertha, thank you. Bertha Coombs. For more on Black Friday and what to expect from the retail sector, let's bring in Cowen senior retail analyst Oliver Chen. Oliver, great to have you with us today. Your most recent note just went out this morning. It said there's no place like home. So what are we expecting in terms of the ones who will win the screen today?
Yeah, Melissa, we were out at Walmart and Target in the mall this morning. Mall traffic down about 30 to 40% in our view. And what we think is online is growing 70% plus. So who's going to win the screen? We like Walmart and Target. We also like American Eagle as well as Tapestry. So there are winners and people are out there shopping. There's long lines in electronics. It's an at-home revolution that's really happening here. It's also deals for days. So the period started earlier, almost as early as October, with Amazon kicking Prime Day, and the season's gone for a long time. Inventories are low, which is good for margins, but inventory availability is pretty good, with the exceptions being video games and electronics, as people really look to Zoom and Cocoon.
Yeah, I mean, the cocooning trade, you mentioned in your note also that appliances are going to be big. I can't imagine gifting a refrigerator, although I could use one and I won't turn that away. Oliver, I wanted to ask you, though, about some of the retailers that are really, they look like they're winning on paper. Bertha was going through some of the big increases in online shopping for the likes of a Macy's as well as a Nordstrom. Walk us through and give us perspective that obviously these are retailers that are losing a lot of traffic in store and they're getting that online a buyer, except that that cost is much higher to fulfill that order.
Yeah, Melissa, what is happening is a lot of these retailers are acquiring new customers online. So the key going forward is to engage this younger customer in particular. Also, the retailers that have been able to survive and raise capital are taking share from those who've gone bankrupt or contracted. Furthermore, with bankruptcies and with this period, there's a lot of rent renegotiation happening too. So all these things are happening. And don't forget, economically speaking, savings rates are higher and you can't spend on travel and you're not spending as much going out. So these are factors that are giving a non-recurring boost. The stimulus helped during the summer. Retailers are really hoping for another stimulus to be a positive factor too. And apparel is all about leisure. So what's been tough is dress and office for sure. But I want an air fryer. So, you know, home is really working too.
Oliver, you know, I wonder about tactically how retailers view this this period when kind of the doorbuster thing, the promotional Black Friday type items for in-store were just these, you know, traffic drivers just to get you to buy other things. And if you're doing it online, do people more just focus in on exactly what they need and don't do the kind of incidental purchases? And who does that benefit and hurt?
Yeah, for sure. It's all about conversion. So the treasure hunt is not happening as much when you're online. You're going straight for the deal. What's really happening is personalization, too. So a lot of the retailers of the future can really identify exactly how you're searching, what you want, and promote to you very uniquely. Kohl's and Ulta have done a good job with collecting data. You know, retail's about magic plus logic. It's about the wow factor and emotions, but logic around AI and thinking about the customer. So that's been a factor. Thinking about promotions, it's been a planned promotional season, very heavy on gifting and very heavy on access price points. That's been good for retailers, and margins have been better on the basis of better inventory control. What we really see is fantastical and functional product. Functional meaning customers looking for value, and then fantasy, customers really looking for feel-good product too. And that's another trend that's important. But that everyday low price is certainly very, very important. And the future is also data.
Yeah, Oliver, speaking of the future, I mean, every Black Friday we talk about the growing importance of online. But given the behavior changes that have taken place over the last 8 months, as you said at the outset, it's even more significant. In fact, it's almost dominant. A year from now, take me out. Do you get anywhere near what mall traffic used to look like? Or is this sort of the seminal moment when it's really changed?
Well, there are so many permanent changes that have accelerated. Thinking about curbside pickup, buy online, pick up in store, the Amazon effect, returns at Amazon at Kohl's, the digital plus the physical, those will all continue to accelerate. Curbside pickup and grocery, a big deal. So fast forward a year, though, we're going to face easy compares. Traffic down 30 and people are itching to dress up and go out and celebrate with family. That will come back over time. However, the vaccine process is likely to be very phased and will strain the supply chain. But there's a pent-up demand for getting out and being with family, you know, in real life. So I think it'll come back. But bigger, better, stronger. What's happened in malls is bifurcation, too. There's much better malls and there's much worse malls. And those worse malls have gotten worse, unfortunately.
Yeah. Oliver, thank you for your time. Appreciate
it. Happy holidays. Great to be here.
Cowan, David.
Thanks, Melissa. When we come back, AstraZeneca defending the handling of its COVID-19 vaccine trial. we're going to take a closer look at which vaccine-related companies may have stocks that are particularly good for your portfolio. Let's take a quick commercial break. We'll come back right after this.
AstraZeneca is likely to run a new global trial of its COVID-19 vaccine candidate. That's according to the company's CEO. He told Bloomberg the drug maker may launch a fresh study testing the vaccine at a lower dosage rather than adding a test of the lower dosage to an ongoing U.S. trial. Joining us for a look at what's next for vaccine makers is Dr. Vimal Divan. He's Mizuho America's senior biopharmaceutical research analyst, and Louise Chen, Cantor Fitzgerald managing director. They both join us now. Louise, recognize you don't cover AstraZeneca directly, but what's your take on the progress of this trial, what it means overall for the market for vaccines eventually?
Yeah, thank you for joining with you this morning. So basically for AstraZeneca, I think the data are somewhat messy and give the market a bit of unease about whether or not this vaccine will be effective enough for the broader population. So I think the question will be, will it make it to the U.S. market, or will it really be Pfizer and Moderna that are going to be the front runners here in the U.S. over the next year or two in terms of vaccinating the broader population? I think the problem with the vaccine is that we're not clear as to what the efficacy is. The 90% efficacy dose was in younger patients, and it was also by mistake and unintentional. So I think another trial probably is warranted for FDA emergency use authorization here in the U.S.
And in your assessment, then, what does it mean for Pfizer, Moderna, assuming they get to market as quickly as we now expect? Does it mean that they therefore will be kind of controlling this entire first phase of the rollout?
Yeah, I think that that's what we're going to be seeing. I think on December 10th, there's going to be a committee that's going to come together and review the regulatory emergency use authorization of the Pfizer vaccine, and then that's going to be followed by the Moderna vaccine. They'll probably have a separate review for that. And so we'll see the FDA documents pretty soon for that. But in the U.S., I think in December, we'll probably likely see an approval for emergency use authorization for both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine, which are both highly efficacious. The data are clean. It's been tested in a total of over 80,000 patients between the two studies. So I think it's very promising in terms of those two being the front runners here in the U.S. and also for next year as well. And it'll be free of charge to patients. And they're going to do a rollout where they're going to look at some of the high-risk population groups, essential healthcare workers, healthcare providers first, and then move on to the broader population once there's a full BLA filing by the two companies.
Dr. Divana, I'm curious if we're eliminating a competitor from the vaccine market in the U.S. next year in AstraZeneca, Oxford. I'm wondering if that changes your assumptions for Pfizer and Moderna in terms of sales, and whether it also changes the assumption of how fast a price of the vaccine will come down. I mean, historically, vaccine prices haven't remained elevated. They've gone down to just a few dollars a dose eventually. So does this alter anything in terms of those timelines?
Yeah, thanks for having me on as well. So I agree with what Louise was saying earlier. This does likely make AstraZeneca more at risk of getting to the market. I think it's interesting. I think it's really going to be about how much Pfizer and Moderna can make in terms of the vaccine. Pfizer's talked about 1.3 billion doses that they hope to make next year. If they can make that much, I think there's certainly going to be the demand to sell that much. Our current estimates in our model only includes what they've already agreed to supply to these various governments. I think it's over 450 million doses now that they've talked about having contract with the U.S., the EU. So we still model based on that. But yes, if they can supply more, there's certainly going to be the demand. And I think there is going to be a lot more in terms of estimates going up, really, for both companies. We don't cover Moderna, but I think for both companies, people are going to get more and more optimistic on how much they'll like to be able to sell.
Yeah, well,
in terms of long-term pricing, I think a few things will still play out.
Sorry, Dr. Van. We hope there's going to be demand for it. I wonder, given there is a lack of confidence among some in the population in terms of taking these vaccines, do you think AstraZeneca, which clearly didn't do the best job here, it would seem, in terms of the going through the data and the trial, do you think that that hurts the overall vaccine effort in terms of people's confidence?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate. I think that, you know, this is obviously a very sensitive area. A lot of people are already nervous about the speed with which this has all happened, obviously the political overtones as well. So I think we need good, clean data. I think for Pfizer, Moderna, luckily they have produced very good, clean data. The FDA seems to be doing the best they can to make everything transparent, having the advisory committee meeting that everyone will be able to see the data and hear the discussion. So that should help. We have other ones coming as well, Johnson & Johnson and other vaccine manufacturers. So hopefully now overall people will get comfortable that these do seem to be very effective and safe vaccines. Unfortunately, I think Astra will be a little bit of a setback to that messaging. But again, there's other players here that should hopefully be allowed.
Yeah, hopefully we do have more options coming. Dr. Devon Louise Chen, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, electric vehicle SPACs have been on a tear this month. Nikola, Lordstown, Fisker. We got a lot of them. You want more? We can give you more. You can see from this chart how those have done, though. An electric vehicle battery startup jumping on the bandwagon, going public today or closing their deal. QuantumScape Corporation and Kensington Capital is what we're talking about. We're going to talk to the CEO of QuantumScape later in the hour. And here's another look at futures. We got about 6.5 minutes till we get started with trading. Remember, it's a 1 o'clock Eastern close for the markets. Welcome back. We got an opening bell a few seconds from now. You know, Melissa, I bet you've covered this company. I'm sure you have on Fast. I don't know if you've noticed, I'm sure you have as well, how much it's moved up, Palantir. But it seems reflective of the speculative nature of some parts of the market here. A $50 billion market value going to be higher even than that today.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it in a lot of different corners of the market. I'm sure Mike can speak to that in terms of the IPO market as well, in terms of the investor desire to be in SPACs, in terms of the investor desire to be in a lot of these speculative EV companies. We're seeing that reach for risk with the markets at record highs.
We are, and we're going to get started right now. As you hear the opening bell, of course, take a look at our real-time exchange right here. Now, I used to say that from the New York Stock Exchange back at HQ, but I've been back at HQ for a while now, Mike, as have you.
Yeah, I have. It's been 5 months, I think.
Yeah, and it's going to be quite a bit longer as well as we take a look here. Only a few more days left in this month, of course, which, as we said, for the Dow at least, has been a very strong one.
Oh, absolutely. Up 11% on the S&P month to date. If you looked at just this week, up about 2%. Backed off just the slightest bit on Wednesday, and right now, we're basically opening at what would be for the S&P at a new closing high. 36.45 is the intraday high. Everything's sort of working together. The big kind of flashing yellow light at the moment is just how overexcited investors have become about this. Everything you look at in terms of how stretched the market is technically, how exuberant sentiment is becoming, it's telling you be careful because people are very excited. We had a 4,500 S&P 500 target thrown out there, I think, by J.P. Morgan by the end of next year. So usually that is the kind of thing you'll see in November into December. It's very difficult to fight the strong seasonal trends, but it's always a question of whether people have gotten the bullish message too strongly. And in fact, if we're going to see another re-rotation, because you do have the Nasdaq once again outperforming with the likes of Tesla picking up.
Well, yeah, good old Tesla. That's a name, of course, you know well as Melissa. You know, I mentioned Palantir in part because, I mean, again, my God, it's up now over 11%, 12%. It just keeps climbing. Melissa, this new cohort that we talked about early on in the pandemic that seemed to be replacing perhaps sports betting with stock picking hasn't gone away. In fact, if anything, it seems to have grown in importance. And I mean, the people who come on here who announced their SPAC deals at the time, they're looking to that cohort as well because they see that they like it, that they move towards it, that it helps them, of course, send their stocks up immediately upon announcement of deals, which is very important. I don't know how long it's going to be with us, but they certainly are showing themselves to be a powerful force.
They are here for now, at least. And you mentioned Tesla. That has been a favorite, of course, among these so-called Robinhood traders, these retail traders that are new to the markets. Tesla's up 40% since the announcement of its inclusion in the S&P 500. And that's in part powered by, of course, more broadly, index managers who need to make their portfolio look more like the index. But, of course, this has been a favorite among these retail investors, and that is helping the momentum here, along with this entire EV space, David. We're going to talk to QuantumScape later on. That should be a really interesting interview in terms of how they stand out. They've got a lot of high-profile backers and people who are speaking very highly of its technology, including the former CTO of Tesla. So that's going to be an interesting one to watch. It's up here 8% right now.
And by the way, I think the headline you're going to be looking for perhaps today is Tesla eclipses Berkshire Hathaway in total market cap. So that's been nip and tuck for a little while. And interestingly, there's also a parallel there because the last very, very large company to go in the S&P was Berkshire Hathaway 10 years ago. And it's similar in the sense, too, that the founder owns almost 20%, which Warren Buffett does with Berkshire. So it goes into the index at somewhat less than a total market cap, but they're going to be basically pretty close. So it's a nice little contrast that the you know, the market gods are giving us.
Dave. We're at 550, call it 551 billion right now.
Yeah.
Wow. Mike, in terms of Tesla's market value.
Yeah, and I think Berkshire looks like just under 550. So
there you go. Yeah. I mean, that's what, number six? I don't know. It's got to be right. It's Apple, it's Alphabet, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook. What am I missing?
Well, so, again, it's because the total market cap is not counted in the index weighting.
Right. They're so I remember deeper. From when Bob was reporting on only 80% of the total market cap.
Exactly.
That is actually
it'll be in
the
top
weighting.
10 or dozen.
Right.
But it won't necessarily go.
But it is number six or five or six overall in terms of U.S.
Total market caps.
Now.
Yeah. And Facebook is you know, 780.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we got the other guys. Apple still below $2 trillion, right around it. 1.99 is where I have it right now. By the way, just quickly back to Palantir, which I keep an eye on. I mean, the lockup there is a ways away. Remember, they would not let a lot of the insiders. It was a direct listing, as is Slack, which we'll talk about in a moment. But a direct listing for Palantir didn't do particularly well initially, if you recall. But that they didn't allow a lot of the insiders who conceivably could have sold to sell more than, I think it was just 20% of whatever they actually had, Melissa. And so we will wait on the lockup there, perhaps. I'm sure there's lots of people lining up looking at this thing going, it's got to be a short. But the question is always when, because you can sit there and just get mowed over.
Look, I'm not sure about the float in terms of, you know, shares available to short and when the options activity opens for this one. But I'm sure there are a lot of people looking at this one very carefully. I wanted to look at CRM. This is one that we are watching into next week on reports that a deal could be announced in days. CRM is recouping some of the losses, as we mentioned, suffered on Wednesday on this deal. And obviously, Mike, this is a deal that would target Microsoft in terms of competition. I mean, these are two companies that have been sort of in competition for quite some time after Microsoft made a bid. Can you, that was amazing. Microsoft making a bid for CRM.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, when you think back on that, that's just staggering to think about. But that actually happened. Obviously, it didn't go through. And then later on, they were both competing for LinkedIn, which, of course, Microsoft won.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's remarkable. And what's interesting is now Slack had that massive run upon this news breaking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe nobody's has numbers necessarily firmly attached to what this might be worth. But it is worth noting that 15% of the shares were still short in Slack. So there were a lot of people caught on the wrong side of that. But now the question is it just more generally in play? It's obviously an interesting and unique asset and a lot. I mean, it's sort of like everything in the digital world trends toward messaging and or advertising. And that's kind of what every other player who doesn't have that piece might be looking for, Dave.
Yeah, well, it had been a laggard as well,
yes.
You know, with a fairly strong business model, but one that was not obviously growing as fast. They had not a particularly good last quarter. In contrast to CRM, the last quarter, which, well, at least one, maybe two back, resulted in that stock climbing enormously. Remember, they added, what, I think 25% market value in about a day or two. You can see it there on Salesforce. That was back in the late August timeframe. You know, not a bad time to use your currency. Listen, Mark Benioff is nothing if not aggressive, always has been. It's just amazing when you think about this company now whose market cap eclipses that of Oracle. It's one of its main rivals, still obviously a key rival. But Microsoft clearly in its sights, and you pointed out, Melissa, I mean, they never actually got to a deal with Microsoft. Microsoft was interested. They never announced anything. He thankfully, in his mind, walked away, of course. He wanted a very, very large number at the time, but certainly well justified. But M&A has been an important part of his strategy overall. This would represent the largest deal that Salesforce has done in terms of at least just the size. We don't know price. None of the reporting on Wednesday gave us sort of that sense in terms of where it might be as a premium to where the stock was in terms of the unaffected stock price. So we'll see. But if you're Salesforce, you certainly want to use this opportunity to use, Mike, what is a very strong currency.
Without a doubt.
And one that trades at high multiples at this point.
And right now, Salesforce is almost exactly 10 times as large in terms of market cap versus Slack. So a big deal, no doubt about it, the biggest in its history, but still not something that's kind of a bet the company size. You know, we have to see about a further premium. But, you know, it's scaling out around those levels. And it's interesting because Slack, one of the knocks was that, you know, you're going to get people to pay. Is it much more a product than a company longer term, and it seems like maybe some of that is coming around.
And you have to wonder, you know, when the reports first came out on Wednesday, it almost sounded just like a trial balloon. It sounded like Slack bankers saying, hey, Slack is for sale. Who else is out there in terms of potential bidders? And so you got to wonder who else might step in, if not CRM, or even if CRM, who else could step in with some sort of bid? And speaking of currency, maybe it's a Zoom. You know, yeah. Zoom, although that seems like a strange
It does seem like, I mean, also a really high multiple company, yeah. growing yeah. that fast. I mean, typically investors don't respond particularly well, even though it might not be a bad idea for the long-term benefit of the overall business. Investors don't like that typically, you know, when you've got that kind of a company at that growth rate. Stepping in for a company that's growing much slower, they sort of wonder, well, what's the problem? You got a real problem. Do you see maybe you're running into at some point you're running into a headwind. You can admit that. It does feel on this one, Melissa, like it's further along. Certainly you do want to get a market check if you can. Sometimes if you are, if you're Slack, I don't know exactly what was behind the leak. Obviously, I didn't report it. Haven't really got a lot of fresh reporting for anybody here, but it does feel just based on the reporting that I've read and having done this for very long time that this thing could be fairly close in terms of it. But your point's a good one. You know, are there any other bidders? You can cross Google off, for example. I don't think they can do anything on it, given antitrust. They're still trying to get that Fitbit deal closed. And then, I don't know, some other names. IBM's kind of tied up already to a certain extent. They seem, I mean, they're certainly willing to do M&A, but, you know, it's not that long a list, although you may know better than I in terms of what would really make a good fit for the company.
No, I do think you would probably be looking at other, you know, enterprise software type, type companies. I mean, Oracle, it would actually fit there, but again, it's smaller, they're busy, presumably,
SAP.
And you know, it's not clear that they would have much to necessarily best a Salesforce proposition at this point. But so it's not one that it seems like has gone unexplored in other areas, but hard to make the match better than Salesforce necessarily.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. We've been telling you about Quantum Space. We mentioned it. We saw the price up about 8% right now. It's a SPAC deal. We'll talk to the CEO of the electric vehicle battery maker. And as we head to break, a look at the movement in Treasury this morning after trading was closed for the Thanksgiving holiday. A reminder, today is an abbreviated session for the bond markets in the United States, closing today at 2 p.m. Eastern time. We do note here yields are moving lower across the board. The 10-year note still well off its highs from November 8th. We are now at 0.855%. November 9th, by the way. That's when the Pfizer vaccine news was announced. Next week, we have a busy economic calendar led by the November jobs report. Stay tuned. Squawk on the Street. We'll be right back.
Electric vehicle battery maker QuantumScape, backed by the likes of Bill Gates, agreeing to merge with Kensington Capital Acquisition Corp. to go public, of course, via SPAC. The combined company remains listed on the NYSE right now, trading under that ticker symbol you see right there, and it is up, the deal having closed this morning. Let's get more on QuantumScape's public debut. Founder and CEO Jagdeep Singh joins us now for a first on CNBC. Nice to see you, sir.
Good morning.
And I'm sure a big day for you, having closed the deal. You know, what do you tell your investor base at this point about your ability to actually get to real revenues and potentially earnings? It's still many years away, is it not?
It is. And I think the key point there, I guess there's a couple of key points. One is, you know, this is the beginning of a massive transformation in one of the largest industries on the planet. And it's going to be a multi-decade long transition. There's a huge opportunity to create, we believe, hundreds of billions of dollars in value over that period of time. But I think the most important point really to make is that, the time to revenue doesn't reflect what traditionally would be thought of as market risk or technology risk. We have technology that works. Our OEM automotive customers have tested it, and we have the support of the largest car company in the world, which is Volkswagen, which is our biggest investor. And really, the time that we now in first revenue is really spent doing two things. One is wrapping up production. Batteries take time to build and scale up. And two is to do the final automotive qualification process, which also takes some time. So it's a little bit different than a traditional company that might be more of a
right.
of an earlier stage play.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, it is one thing for things to work in a laboratory and another things for them to work at scale. You're confident that your battery, the solid state battery, that, of course, will be able to be charged more quickly and obviously give a longer life, that it will be able to work at scale and you'll be able to produce it at scale?
Well, what we're confident of is that the fundamental science risk is behind us because the battery has already been tested at automotive power conditions by the automotive OEMs themselves. And I think relative to scaling up production, we obviously understand our technology well. We know the processes that are involved making it. But keep in mind that the production partnership is with Volkswagen. We have a joint venture with VW where we're going to jointly make these batteries to scale. And obviously VW knows how to make a very high volume, very high quality products in the marketplace. So, yes, I think we're pretty comfortable that, we're going to be able to scale this now that the technology works.
Jagdeep, there are a lot of players in this space in particular making great strides in terms of battery efficiency. Tesla is hiring right now actively for its aggressive push in lithium-ion batteries. There's another company out there called Solid Power, which bills itself as all solid state. Can you speak to the technology? Are you completely solid state? Are you some sort of hybrid that uses a liquid or a gel for its electrolytes, and where does it stack up in terms of in terms of efficiency and power compared to an equivalent lithium ion?
Sure. So the key characteristic that defines the solid state cell is that the separator, which is the material that keeps the anode and cathode apart, is entirely solid state. It's a ceramic material that doesn't burn. Once you have that separator that's a solid ceramic, you can eliminate the traditional anode, which is either carbon or silicon. And once you do that, you get all the benefits that you referred to earlier, which is you get energy density that's 80% higher. You get fast charge, which you can't do with any other typical cells, either solid state or liquid base. And you get the safety benefits of the ceramic being non-combustible. So the key point here to make is that all the improvements that are being worked on in the lithium-ion battery space, things like, you know, better cathode materials with more nickel content, things like better manufacturing processes for the cells. All those benefits still apply to the solid-state cell that QuantumScape has, with the difference that we don't need that extra anode material, which saves both cost and volume, and therefore we leverage the industry's learning curve with the additional benefit of not needing that extra material, giving you the additional benefits of solid-state.
In terms of cost to the OEM, Jagdeep, I'm curious as to whether Volkswagen believes it will be able to mass produce a car using this solid state battery at a competitive price to a car that uses an equivalent lithium ion battery. And I'm wondering at what point do you achieve scale enough for that to happen or maybe even to surpass in terms of bringing the cost down, the efficiencies of lithium ion?
Well, this is, in fact, the key reason why we exist as a company. We believe that this fundamental transformation that I referred to earlier, this, you know, this 100 million unit a year market that today is only 2% penetrated by EVs, needs a better battery in order to really see a higher penetration of EVs in that marketplace. And that better battery needs to be a battery that can close the gap between today's battery technology and the combustion engine. And what that means is you need longer range, you need 300 to 500 miles of range, you need faster charge times, you know, you can refuel a gasoline-powered car in minutes as opposed to an hour that takes today's batteries. We're targeting 15 minutes, which gets a lot better. And you need the safety that you get from conventional engines as opposed to today's batteries. So today's liquid batteries just don't get there. And that's why the solid-state battery is so important. It really starts to close the gap between EV-based powertrains and combustion engine-based powertrains. So absolutely, we believe that as we get this battery into production and on the road, that it starts to make EVs a lot more competitive with combustion engines, enabling the completion of this transition of the automotive powertrain.
So Deepa, I'm just curious, I mean, I know you're not an expert necessarily in the capital markets, but, well, I kind of am sometimes. So, you know, the SPAC fervor that we've seen, you've benefited from that. And I just wonder, you're a development company at this point, obviously still not to get the product to, fully to market, as you've explained here. Where would you have gone for capital if this SPAC world didn't exist? Do you think you would have had access to it effectively?
Well, so in our case, we already had access to the capital. You know, we had a balance sheet close to $500 million in cash, pre this transaction. And then with this transaction, we raised another $700 million more. So we'll have, north of $1 billion on the balance sheet, which we really think is helpful to help scale up production. But we didn't do this transaction because we didn't have access to capital. We did it because it really allows us to accelerate the production and commercialization of this important technology.
And you are going to be able to get to revenue positive and free cash flow and all those other exciting things with the cash that you currently have on hand?
Yeah. In fact, this capital more than fully funds us through the first factory that we're building with Volkswagen. So not only do we get real cars on the road, but we have additional capital left over that can help us scale to our subsequent factories. So I think this has been a good process for us. I took a company public in the past, and the normal way IPO is a year-long process, and it's pretty complicated. This is a much more streamlined process. I mean, I think obviously there'll be good SPAC deals and bad SPAC deals.
Yeah.
We have to think we're a good one. But the process, the SPAC process in general, I'm guessing is one that's here today, just because it's so much more streamlined and efficient than other ways to access public market.
No doubt. And it's certainly benefiting you right now. And you've certainly done a good job, at least it would seem, communicating even during the course of our interview, as your stock has gone up another 12% from where it started. Jagdeep, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure.
All right, still to come, Shopify and its shareholders have reasons to feel jolly. The stock is up more than 150% this year, backing off just 0.5% this morning. Hear what Shopify's president has to say about the holiday shopping season later this morning on Squawk Out.
Many families are breaking long-standing traditions this year because of the pandemic, but retailers may be getting a boost in other ways. Contessa Brewer joins us now from Kingston, New York. Hey, Contessa.
Hi there, Melissa. Here at Adams Fairacre Farms, the lights are on and the fresh cut trees are out in the nursery. I wish we had smell-o-vision because it smells amazing. Today, for many families, this would kick off the traditional start of holiday decorating season. But this year is not normal. People have started pulling out their Christmas bins and decking the halls earlier than ever. It's kind of a go big and go home mentality. People are looking to pierce the pandemic gloom by embracing the traditions that don't require social distancing. Sarah Gore, host of Open House, put up her first decorations right after Halloween. She's doing the bathroom, the dining room, and every space in between.
I think we're grasping at straws here with trying to get, a smile on our face and our kids too. And I think if decorations will help, by all means, more is more and more is better, in my opinion.
In their most recent earnings calls, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Target all mentioned the enthusiasm shoppers have for home holiday. Target's Brian Cornell says after talking to guests, they're clearly telling us they want to celebrate this holiday season, but they know it's going to be very different. Adams is a regional chain, upscale grocery, home goods, garden. Sales of holiday up 57% since October 1st, Melissa.
You've been listening to the opening hour of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.